All right, well, let's make sure you're in fellowship if necessary, rebound. If not, then let's get back into this, dealing with these two characters, Hymenaeus and Alexander. And now we're ready to deal with this issue of delivering them over to Satan. We're at point 49. The next statement about being delivered over to Satan has prompted a great deal of discussion, but has generally led to a couple of specific conclusions. 50, the first question that must be addressed is whether or not this act of delivering people over to Satan was a judicial act reserved for apostles only. Was this a part of apostolic authority? Because if it was, then only they could do it. And then certainly when the apostles passed off the scene, no one else could do this. And so we only have a couple of examples, and they both are done by an apostle. So that begs the question, is this something that would fall under pastoral authority, or is this something that was apostolic in nature? 51, there are only a couple of examples of this in the New Testament, so we would conclude that the practice was probably not widespread, but was reserved for extreme cases. Now, we're probably all familiar with the most notable case, or maybe the second most notable case, depending on whether or not you think Hymenaeus and Alexander, and that is the incestuous Corinthian, the guy that was apparently having a sexual relationship with his stepmother. There's no evidence that it was his mother, but certainly this was a practice that was frowned upon in normal society even at that time. And the Corinthian church is known for this. That's what you want to be known for in the angelic conflict, immorality. What characterizes your church? Oh, a lot of immorality. Yes, no, I don't think so. And some have suggested, well, the Corinthians were still a church. Yes, they were a church. But if our church has to be known for something, I would rather it not be that. Let it be known that they apply doctrine at a high level, they show good hospitality, they're great believers, not that they're an immoral bunch of weirdos. That is not cool. And so out of this immorality comes the issue of it wasn't being dealt with by the leadership of the church. They were just tolerating it, not only tolerating it, but apparently using it as a springboard to talk about how gracious they were. See how gracious and wonderful we are. We tolerate anything. You can come to our church and do anything. If you like goats, we don't have a problem with that. Yeah, we do have a problem with that. I'm being facetious, of course. But you can pick any sort of aberration out there and say, well, it's just a matter of grace that we accept it. No. No, grace has limits. Even God's grace, you know, we talk about grace and we love grace and we all want it when we sin, of course. We recognize the marvelous nature of it. But even God's grace has limits. It's not unlimited. It's not unlimited at a personal level, and it's not unlimited in terms of time. There's going to come an end to God's grace for some people. They're going to come under his judgment. And so the reality is here, of course, the incestuous Corinthian is one of the most notable examples of this. And so Paul delivers him over to Satan for the destruction of the flesh. And this and of course, this poses a lot of questions, too, in this passage. Do you do this for every immoral person? Was this an extreme case of immorality? Or, you know, in some quarters, frankly, it's disturbing to me. But in some quarters, I think some people think, well, if he had just married her, then everything would have been all right. I don't get that from reading this passage. I get the fact that, no, that wasn't cool, and Paul wasn't ever going to be down with it. And this guy was under some pretty severe judgment. And apparently, all of this had its desired effect. From 2 Corinthians, we get the impression, if not the outright implication, that this guy recovered spiritually and broke this off and got his act together. And probably after a lot of pretty severe discipline. Certainly he was put out of the church. That ought to wake, if a person is a positive believer, that ought to be a frightening concept, that you can be asked to leave and not come back. And so we have, as a part of our fear of God, we have a certain fear of, you know, I would be afraid of being put out of the church. I wouldn't like that thought. Now, that's not the only motivation I have for doing right. I don't just do right because, oh, well, they might put me out of the church. And so this guy, he apparently got his act together, which is good. And I would assume after some pretty severe discipline. But this was the only other example we have of this in the New Testament. Now, again, is this only for extreme cases of immorality like incest, or would Paul have done this if they were trumpeting any form of immorality, as how grace-oriented their church was? We again, just accept anybody. Well, 52, the first example clearly deals with blatant immorality, while our example deals with the rejection of the good conscience and serious doctrinal deviation. 53, further, there is no evidence in the pastoral epistles that Paul commands those under his charge to engage in such activity. He seems to take the lead in this. There's no indication that he ever tells Timothy to do it, and none of the other letters in the New Testament even mention it. It's my opinion, probably, that this was apostolic prerogative, and Paul was the only one who appears to have done it that we know about, not that the other apostles might not have. But it is for very, very severe cases, at any rate. But now, given what we have in the state of the church today, where we have all these, and rightly so, I think, we have, as it were, bylaws, the Constitution, in which we can deal with believers under discipline if we need to. So we don't really have to deliver anybody over to Satan. But the idea, I think, of being put out of the church speaks to that very issue. If you were to commit a serious enough offense that the membership and or the leadership of the local church had to put you out, effectively, I think you're going to become Satan's punching bag. And that is for good reason. It's designed, of course, to have a salutary effect. It's designed to help you pull your head out and get your act together. And that's one of the things we'll see here with the verb he uses. So second here, the 54 here, the second area of difficulty involves exactly what is in view when a believer is delivered over to Satan. And so both of these situations, as we know, or at least with the Corinthian, it had a beneficial effect. There's no indication that this worked on Hymenaeus and Alexander that we know of. Because 5 years later, apparently Hymenaeus is still pulling his stunts. 4 or 5 years later when Paul writes 2 Timothy. Now, it does appear to have worked for the Corinthian. And so the goal of any sort of discipline ever is not just to discipline the person. It's to help them spiritually. And you can't lose sight of that. So, A, is it full exclusion from the local church with all the attendant blessings, associations, and privileges? B, is it the infliction of some physical punishment, disease, or even the sin unto death? If this happens, well, 55, many are agreed that both may be in view, with emphasis on the fact that the believer is placed back into the world to live under the rule of Satan, who may inflict any number of things on him. John 12:31, and so in the New Testament theology, and certainly Paul is very much indicative of this, recognize that the world, the cosmos out there, is Satan's venue. He is the head of it. He is the ruler of it, in fact. And all these, in this kingdom of darkness out there over which he rules, he calls the shots. Obviously, we know that Satan can only function at whatever level the permissive will of God allows him to. But God appears to allow him a lot of latitude. I mean, let's face it. I mean, Satan's fall, we don't know exactly when it occurred. It was pre-restoration. So Satan's been loose, you know, doing his thing for at least 6,000 years that we know of. And God hasn't quickly dealt with him. I mean, quickly from our perspective, he has not. But for God, you know, this thing is playing out as his eternal plan decreed. And so 12:31 here, now judgment is upon this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out. And Jesus recognized that this world was Satan's. And when Satan presented to him all the kingdoms of the world, showed them to him in a moment of time, and offered them to him, if he'd just worship him, Jesus didn't argue with him and say, this isn't yours to give. Satan has usurped this authority because of the fall of man. And as we saw in Revelation there, that the Jesus Christ is going to effectively, Satan is a squatter. He is taken over in the absence of what we might call the landlord. And the Lord is going to restore possession of this world to himself. And that's going to entail all the events, as we saw in Daniel's 70th week. A lot of horrific things are going to happen before he takes control of this world or resumes control of it at that level. And ejects Satan and his squatters, the demons, who were never designed to rule over planet Earth. That was never God's plan. As we saw in the book of Revelation, it was always God's plan for a man to rule. And that's why he put man in charge. Now, man abrogated his authority, or abdicated his authority, and gave it over to Satan. And so Satan all too willingly grabbed it and said, okay, fine. But God's not going to allow that forever. So this is viewed as his world. Ephesians 2:2, also all these passages are very consistent in that they recognize the ruler, the prince of darkness, is the ruler over all of this. In which you formerly walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, that spirit which is now working in the SODs, the sons of disobedience. And so Satan is ruling out there, calling the shots, and people are all too willingly going right along with him. And one of the things we observe in this is that Satan's world is becoming a worse and worse place as we go. So Ephesians 6:12 also deals with this concept that our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. And 1 John 5:18 and 19 speaks of the relationship of the cosmos to the prince of darkness, to the ruler of this world. We know that no one who is born of God sins. Boy, if you take that verse out of context, you're going to be in trouble. But he who is born of God keeps him, and the evil one does not touch him. We know that we are of God. And the whole world, chimai, lies, reclines, leans back. That the world is viewed as lying in the lap of Satan, and they're all too comfortable with it. They don't have any problem with the evil and the darkness. That goes right to their nature. Why? Because their deeds are evil. So they reject the light. They gravitate towards the darkness. So 56, as Kelly has stated, this certainly connoted excommunication from the church, the realm of God's care and protection, and the formal handing over of the believer to Satan. In the mind of the primitive church, this did not simply mean that he left the congregation and resumed a peaceful life in pagan society. Such a man was thought really to be exposed to the malice of the evil one, and physical disaster was fully anticipated. And so it doesn't happen immediately, though. That much we do know. If the Hymenaeus is the same one, and there's no reason I could see to believe he's not, he's still out there doing this stuff under the judgment of God and continuing on. So 57, it is clear that God did not desire the physical death of these current enemies of the faith, as seen in the purpose clause at the end of verse 20. So that, in order that, why is he delivering them over? He's got a purpose. 58, since he uses the verb paiduo, some have limited this to the idea of simply providing instruction that results in an informed and responsible lifestyle. We might call it simple education. However, 59, a careful study of the term, coupled with the context in which we find it here, indicates that physical chastisement was a regular feature involved in the meaning of this word. Luke 23, where it is used. So again, we get our term pedagogue from this, which is essentially a teacher. But there was a lot of things involved in the idea of the word that we don't have involved in our idea of a teacher today. One of the things you see regularly, you cannot exercise corporal punishment as a teacher today. And that's too damn bad, because it was certainly involved in this word in the ancient world. And, of course, we've lost control of our classrooms because of this. We might blunt the little child's STA or give him a bad idea of himself. And, of course, that lined me out when I was a kid. I mean, if you knew, I got swats exactly twice. But, boy, they didn't mind applying them either. And you knew. That thought was always over your head. If I don't listen to the teacher and I don't obey, I'm going to get swats. And nobody likes swats. Grab your ankles. Oh, I want to grab my ankles. you're going to hit me. It's going to hurt. And of course, you try not to cry because, you know, you're a tough guy then. I'm not going to cry. Hurt like hell, though, I'll tell you what. And then the dangerous thing was I got to tell my dad. Then I was really concerned with what might happen. Because my parents made it no big secret. If you acted up at school, they were going to deal with you when you got home. And so the teachers all knew, at least at that period in history, in the 60s, at some level, that they had control over their classrooms. And I got SWAT specifically twice, and, you know, I didn't want them anymore at all. So Luke 23:16 here is where the word is used. I will therefore here punish him in verse 16 and release him. And let me double check that. Yeah, it's Paidu. Okay. They've translated it punish, which captures the nuance here because he's going to flog him. And also verse 22, same thing. And they said to him the third time, why, what evil has this man done? I have found in him no guilt demanding death. I will therefore punish him again and release him. So the emphasis in these passages, and you can see these other ones, 1 Corinthians 11:32, Hebrews 12:6, and Revelation 3:19, where the idea behind the word focuses in these passages on the aspect of punishment. So 60, therefore these two men are being released to Satan's custody, who would be allowed under the permissive will of God to inflict them as he desired. And 61, one would assume that if the corrective did not have the desired effect, they would remain under Satan's rule until their physical deaths. It isn't as though they were going to be invited back to the local church. I don't anticipate that from what Paul says here. That when he takes such a drastic step as this, that if changes aren't forthcoming, this is the end of the line. And that ought to be a really frightening thought that, you know, I've come to the end of the line spiritually. Oh, you may go out there and live in the devil's world, but to me, that would be a horrible thought. So 62, the goal was to discipline them in such a way that they would learn not to blaspheme. 60, the term blasphemeo is defined as demeaning through speech, to speak in a disrespectful way that demeans, denigrates, or maligns. 64, Paul's ultimate purpose, and God's as well, is that by turning the offenders over to the power and influence of Satan, this will teach them not to insult the Lord by denigrating the faith. God takes the doctrine pretty seriously, apparently. And since they've repudiated the faith, he repudiates them. And that is not a good thing. 65, although the individual pastor teachers do not have apostolic authority, each one is responsible for the doctrinal content over the local church where God the Holy Spirit made him an overseer. 66, he must monitor the congregation at a close enough level that he is aware of any dangerous forms of teaching that may arise among the ranks. And 67, again, we are not talking about legitimate and open discussions of doctrines, difficult passages, or how to apply in a given circumstance. We are talking about teaching that effectively undermines the faith. Good, serious doctrinal conversations, even if you have disagreements, are healthy. Because, number one, it shows your thinking. And it shows that you're considering the issues. And that you can articulate things. And that's good. And so we're in favor of that when believers get together. Even they don't have to agree on every little fine point of doctrine. And you've got to get over that and allow people the freedom to function. But obviously, you know, now we're not going to tolerate people teaching, you know, or saying that the resurrection has taken place. That we will not tolerate. Or if you want to start advocating the gift of tongues or something else weird, we deal with that. But again, this idea of people getting together and discussing, even if they don't agree on everything, it's good. It's healthy. I would rather have an intellectually open environment in which people were free to disagree than have this closed-minded sort of mentality where people don't even think or are afraid to speak because, oh my God, what'll happen next? And so I don't even demand that everybody agree with me. So I wouldn't want to go to a local church where that demand was made. I can spell cult. You got to agree with everything I say or you're out. What? That was not how I was raised spiritually. And how are believers going to grow on their own at any rate? They're going to just listen to you and they can't think for themselves? I don't think so. That doesn't work for me. And I hope it doesn't work for you. So again, we're not talking about legitimate discussions. I enjoy frank discussions of doctrine, even if it's difficult. You know, it doesn't hurt anything. So 68, a local church should be a place within reason in which believers are free to think for themselves, carefully consider the teachings, and be able to place their stamp of approval on the doctrine. 69, I mean, I say within reason because believers should also recognize the danger of simply dismissing certain teachings because they don't understand them, don't like them, or haven't heard them previously, which manifests a certain amount of arrogance. It's like with the doctrine of spiritual gifts. Like I said, that was 20 years, and that was really the first attempt that I did at going through it. And I'm all for improving it and changing it and all of that, but I'm sure there were things in there you'd never heard before. But again, you've got to be able to think outside the box sometimes, or you're just going to end up parroting what's been taught, whether it's right or wrong. It's one thing if you're parroting what's right. That's okay, I guess. But still, you're just parroting. You have to figure these things out for yourself and think through them. And if you're parroting what's wrong, well, that's just god-awful. I've heard it dogmatically said for 25 years, you can't argue with this. Sure I can. Watch. I can argue with it. Give me a chance. I like to argue. I was born to argue, I think. I feel like Paul kind of in this first chapter. You want to argue about the law? I was the greatest law arguer that ever was. You want to discuss the law? Now you're up against Paul. That would have been interesting to see some of those conversations. So again, you don't parrot. You've got to think for yourself. All believers have to. 70, if any believer begins to advocate unorthodox doctrine and attempts to influence others with said doctrines, he will be warned and given time to cease and desist in a general sense from the pulpit. I don't feel like I have to deal with this very much. If it's going on out there, I'm frankly unaware of it. But it may be going on and I'm not aware. But I figure, as any good leader should, that God will get you the information when you need it, if you need it. And some things are really just generally harmless. And one of the things that really has galled me over the years is, you know, some believer might do some little harmless something, or maybe they blow it. Maybe they have an STA day and, you know, they get out and they make a fool out of themselves and blah, blah, blah. And they're just railed on from the pulpit. Look, what kind of an idiot would do something like me? Look, I've had STA days. I don't want to be railed on from the pulpit just because I had a bad day. And so you got to allow people time and space to think and free and to make mistakes. I mean, God doesn't kill me every time. I'm not perfect. So, again, taking all these things, it doesn't have to be done that way. I mean, if it's really, really serious and I'm aware of it, I'll address it. But for the most part, I don't, unless I've got a lot of problems out here that I'm not aware of, and then I'll have to deal with them. So 71, as a believer, you may become at least partially responsible to confront this type of activity if you become aware of it. It's not all just on me. I mean, certainly I know where the buck stops here. But if you're a believer and you're hearing a bunch of weird doctrine and weird, strange things out of people, and you should kind of address that. You should be a friend to them and say, hey, this is weird. This isn't what the Bible teaches. And deal with it. So 72, you can approach the believer, inform him of his error, and give him time to change his mind. 73, if he does not and the doctrine continues to be attacked, you may enlist the aid of another believer that sees the same error and confront the errant believer again. 74, if that doesn't bring the desired change of mind, well, you're going to have to take it to the leadership next. And we will take the matter under advisement. We assume that we don't assume. We would hear the thing out first and not just assume that just because you had a complaint about somebody that you were necessarily right. We couldn't make that assumption. You'd have to hear each thing on an individual basis. And you have rights and responsibilities and privileges in the local church to encourage one another, to exhort one another, to forgive one another, to teach one another, and all that. And so I don't think for a second the only teaching that goes on, I don't think for a second, just only comes from the pulpit. I learn stuff from other believers. I learn things from them in social settings. I learn things from talking about things. Sometimes it forces me to reevaluate a position. One of the things I've noticed, especially over the last 3 or 4 years, is, my first pass through, I can make some pretty wild statements. I can make some extreme statement that on the surface may not be horrible, but it's an extreme position. And so you don't have to exaggerate everything to get people's attention. There's a place for exaggeration, I suppose. But I prefer to be more even-handed rather than make these sweeping pronouncements that can't possibly be wrong. Yeah, they can. So again, we would take it under advisement. We'd look at it. We'd check it out. And assuming you're correct, point 75, the errant believer will be contacted, questioned as to his motives, ideas, etc., and given a chance to explain his position. 76, if the board does not agree that his teaching is harmless, he will be instructed to cease and desist and informed that said position is not welcomed in this local church. I've been here 17 years and we've never had to do this. So this is, again, this whole delivering Satan over to Satan is certainly an extreme case. And when you have to deal with believers under discipline, that's extreme. And I've never had to do it. And, my prayer is never would have to. So, again, if the teaching's not harmless, okay, well, fine. Or if the board deems, it's all right if he has that position. It may bug you, but we don't see it as a threat. So, again, you have to have your ducks in a row and all your doctrinal house in order and your cards in order. And, then that's how you deal with it. 77, if he refused to listen to two or three believers, refuses to listen to the leadership, and continues in said teachings or activities, he will be removed from the membership and not allowed to attend Bible class. But I hope we never have to do that. It's not anything I would look forward to. I want everybody here to make it spiritually. That's kind of the whole goal, I thought. But we have these things in order, and we have to have these policies at some level and procedures because you have to be prepared. You can't just blither through life and just assume, well, this will never happen here. Well, you don't know what will happen. I don't know what will happen. Then that's why we have policies and procedures like in the Constitution. What if I become a raving cuckoo clock? Stop teaching doctrine? Go off and get under, I don't know what I would pursue, but I can't think of anything, but whatever it might be. Advanced higher mathematical concepts and start communicating that to you instead of doctrine or attempt to overlay doctrine. That. And so you have a place, you have a way to say, okay, the pastor's become a nut. And we're getting rid of him. And you vote me out. And that's a protection for everybody. And all these things really are for protection. I don't hope we never have to do any of that. I hope I never become a raving nut. But jury's out on all of us, isn't it? Till we get to the Bema seat, you never know. I've seen some people that I had extreme confidence in crash and burn after 20, 30 years on doctrine. And I've seen other people that I wouldn't give you a plug nickel for them. And they're still in there plugging away, applying, growing, and all that. So it just goes to show, we can all have faulty judgments. And I've learned not to think that I'm infallible. It was nice thinking I was infallible for a while. But that doesn't last. If you're very honest, you really know you're not. So again, we have all these things, and they're really for protection. So everybody can safely assimilate doctrine and grow up in an environment that's healthy. And that's the problem with the false teachers. They were creating an unhealthy environment. And ultimately, the believers under their deal were going to suffer. And that we don't want. So 78, if he is not a member of the church and becomes a divisive force, he will simply be told he is no longer welcome to receive doctrine in this local church. So we have ways to protect ourselves. We have to. Again, the idea, you wouldn't invite a wolf into the middle of the flock and say, hey, have fun. That would be kind of dangerous. So, again, hopefully none of this will ever occur. 79, the reason we continue to attempt to do things properly and in an orderly fashion is to protect the local congregation and not simply allow anyone to act unilaterally in matters of church discipline. I can't even act unilaterally in the matters of discipline. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, if you get into a local church where the pastor has all power and authority and can do anything he wants, Scary. We know that power corrupts, and what do we know about absolute power? It corrupts absolutely. These things are, I wouldn't want to be in that kind of an organization where somebody can just do this. So, A.D., the pastor-teacher is under the royal imperative not to give a factious man an audience after a first and second warning. So, if you have that, unfortunately, as again, I say I'm fairly blessed, I think, because I don't have any of this. I don't see any factious people here. That is Titus 3:9-11, where Paul says, but this gets into these foolish controversies, these stupid things that they're teaching. Foolish controversies, as he says, genealogies and strife and disputes about the law, for they are unprofitable and worthless. Reject a factious man after a first and second warning. And again, the factious man is not somebody who disagrees with an isolated thing here or there. This is a real dangerous person. And thinking people, if they're positive and all that, to me, they're not dangerous. Not to say they couldn't be, but the idea here is if you're a thinking person and you're positive and you really want the truth, I don't see you becoming a factious person. You may go through a period or whatever, but, you know, the fact is I wouldn't see this happening. It could. So after a first and second warning, knowing that such a man is perverted and is sinning, being self-condemned. 81, in that regard, my mandate is to proclaim the word, document my positions, give you time to assimilate it and orient to it, and allow you time and space to grow up spiritually. 82, this does not mean that you have to believe everything I believe. You may not have come to the point in your spiritual growth where you see things clearly regarding a given issue. Maybe something, you know, I need to grow up in a position that might need to be modified or changed. But how are we ever going to do that if we don't talk? How are we ever going to figure anything out? But the pastor-teacher is not to tolerate those that are divisive and attempt to involve others in their faction. So he has a mandate there. He's got to protect the flock. 83, one should recognize that the goal is to win the errant believer back to the truth if possible. Always recognizing that God must ultimately provide the corrective. 2 Timothy 2:25, this is where people have to recognize at a certain level it's up to the Lord. That you're not here to be a one-man doctrinal wrecking crew. That God has to get through to people. And that the ultimate teacher is the Holy Spirit. It's not you. I'm the physical teacher, but ultimately it's got to come from God. 2 Timothy 2:25, with gentleness correcting those that are in opposition. If perhaps God may grant them a change of mind, repentance, leading to the knowledge of the truth, so that they may come to their senses and escape from the snare of the devil, having been held captive by him to do his will. So, 84, the very serious nature of all these proceedings should not be lost on any of us. We should recognize that any believer can become a casualty and conduct ourselves in the fear of the Lord. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And so, again, we have a lot of motivations for serving God, not the least of which fear is a legitimate, bona fide motivation. This is the way children learn. It's the first thing they respond to, is the threat of punishment. You say, well, I don't want my kids to be afraid of me. Oh, I did. I damn well want them to be afraid of me. I want them to recognize that if you don't toe the line, there are going to be ramifications. There are going to be repercussions to your actions. And at a certain level, if you got the bluff in on them, now you got to be willing to back it up. But if they got the fear, you know, I'm going to tell your dad. That was always, you know, what your mama said. Wait till your dad gets home. Oh, God. Uh-oh. I crossed the line. I'm in trouble. And guess what? Dad, typically, and as in most families, the dad was primarily the biggest disciplinarian. And I think that's a part of the male nature, why they're better at it than females. And I'm glad, you know, I'm glad we have women. What the world be like if we didn't have women? But I recognize that women aren't typically the big disciplinarians in the family, and that's okay, I think. They should enforce discipline, of course. I mean, if they don't, they're going to raise a little hellion that, you know, nobody will want to be around, including them. As we know, if children get their way, they bring shame on their parents. So, but I, you know, fear is a bona fide motivation. And, you know, again, I don't always do things. I'd like to say I did. Well, I just do things because I just love the Lord. That's always my motivation. No. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's the thought of reward. I do it for SG3. Sometimes I do things because I'm motivated by fear of what would happen if I don't. And again, we have a lot of reasons to serve the Lord, and we have a lot of motivations, and the fear is a legitimate one in this case. All right, well, let's dive into chapter 2. We'll at least get the exegesis done here before we quit today of the first couple of verses. First of all, then, now Paul begins here with having dealt with the initial deal of the false teachers and what's going on in Ephesus. And now he gives some marching orders to Timothy here with respect to how he wants the church run. What things he wants implemented or reinstated, we might say. Because I would assume Paul had taught these things on a previous occasion, that this wasn't new information to Timothy. First of all, then, I urge that entreaties, prayers, petitions, and thanksgiving be made on behalf of all men. First of all, then, actually, is first is protos in the Greek word order here. It is a little different, obviously, than the English. First, as opposed to last. First in order, first importance, first in sequence. First of all things, genitive plural of the adjective pos. First of all things, therefore, or then, is the inferential conjunction un. Here not used so much in the sense of inference, other than maybe he's saying their emphasis is this, but I want your emphasis to be this. So it does kind of reach back at least into chapter 1. First of all, then, I urge is parakaleo. Here, this word has a broad set of ways it can be translated. Comes from kaleo, to call, alongside. So it has the idea of exhortation, urging someone to a particular course of action. It can even be used in a more strong sense, almost of command, although it's not, I don't think it is here. But first of all, then, I urge or encourage. To be made is a poieo here, a complimentary infinitive. I urge, what does he urge? Well, he wants prayers to be made. Prayers is deesis, entreaties is the way they've translated here, deesis. This word means an asking or a request, literally. Plural, all these are plurals, by the way. Then, pros UK, prayers, this is the most general term for prayer in the New Testament. It's used most often. Prayers, and a prayer means exactly that. It's a request to a deity. We understand what prayer is. Prayers, petitions, is entuxis. E-N-T-E-U-X-I-S. Two times this word's used, literally a meeting with someone is the idea, a conversation. A conference, an interview. Here they translated it by the term petitions. And thanksgivings is Eucharistia. E-U-C-H-A-R-A-S-T-I-A. Charistia, I-S-T-I-A. This word means exactly that, gratitude, gratefulness, or thankfulness. On behalf of, or for the sake of, preposition huper, all men is the adjective pos with the genitive of anthropos. For kings and all who are in authority, in order that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. On behalf of kings is a preposition again, huper, with the term basileus, B-A-S-I-L-E-U-S, kings, and Chi, all, again, adjective pos, all the ones being, literally. You have here the definite article plus the participle of I mean. All the ones being in authority. Preposition in with the locative of huper ake. H-U-P-E-R-O-C-H-E. Literally, this means an elevated place, hence a position of prominence or authority. And we understand what authority is both on in the royal chain of command, but here, of course, he's emphasizing the establishment chain of command. All those in authority in order that. Now, you have two choices here on how you're going to classify hina. They've translated in the New American Standard. They took it as purpose. Hina is also used to introduce indirect discourse sometimes. So what are we to pray? This could be either the purpose of why we are to pray or the prayer. The content of the prayer is they'll do their job so we can do ours, in a sense, that the church can function as it's supposed to. And how does the church best function? In a peaceful and orderly society. So again, here, depending on here, I took it as the content of the prayers, but both may be in view. The idea is we're praying for a specific purpose. In order that way may lead is diago, D-I-A-G-O. Two times this means to lead through or across. Hence, how one passes their life, how they live their daily existence. We may live, then you've got here, eremos, this adjective, E-R-E-M-O-S, eremos. One time this means it's used as a manner of living. Means quiet, peaceful, tranquil. You keep to yourself, you mind your own business, and all that. And hesukios, tranquil and quiet life. H-E-S-U-C-H-I-O-S. Hesukios, this means inner calm or tranquility. It also does have the, you know, it's used also of external quietness, of, you know, as peace and quiet, we might say. And that's kind of the nuance of all of this. We want to live a peaceful and quiet life. We don't want to bother anybody. We're here as ambassadors for Christ. We're not here to be rabble-rousers. We're not here to be problems for society. We are here to represent Jesus Christ in our manner of living. And for the most part, if you study the life of Christ, I mean, he had his run-ins with the authorities, as we know. But they were trying to kill him, and that kind of, you know, makes it tough. But generally speaking, you know, he paid taxes. You know, I'd like to be able to go get mine out of the mouth of a fish, but, you know, it doesn't work that way, I don't guess. So, but he didn't generally bother the authorities. He wasn't, and we know that, you know, one of his disciples was a zealot, and they were big on political overthrow. But Jesus never advocated any of that or never gave any inclination that that's what he was doing. And neither are we. So we may leave a peaceful, I translate here, a tranquil and quiet life. Life is bios. Of course, this is the, we get our word biology from this root. Life or lifestyle, how one operates, the manner in which he lives. In, and literally it's in every, they've translated it here in all. But when you have pos with the anarthrous substantive, the better translation is every. With every form of godliness, eusebia. Eusebia here, E-U-S-E-B-I-A. 15 times this word used means reverence or respect toward God, piety, devotion to deity. That we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. You got chi with semnotes. S-E-M-N-O-T-E-S. Semnotes means, actually it refers to behavior that is kind of over and above the norm, that sort of demands respect. Behavior that is serious or dignified, that causes one to be recognized as one who's proper and respectable. So we're going to stop there today. Our time is all but up, and I don't want to dive into this, so we will be ready here to resume and to cover the importance of these verses on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.